Okay. Good evening, everyone. We're back on the air. And this week is Parashas Mishpatim, Tavshin Ayin Tes. Page 416 in the Art Scroll. We'll start from the beginning of the Parasha. Ve'ela Mishpatim Asher Tosim Lefneihem. These are the judgments, the ordinances that you shall place before them. Now, the setup of the parashas are, we have last week's parasha, the giving of the Torah. After the completion of the telling of the giving of the Torah, there are a few laws mentioned. Laws about the Mizbeach, about the altar, to bring sacrifices upon. And then we come to Mishpatim, ordinances. We go through the Torah goes through a whole list of many, many mitzvahs. So, you know, if you think about it, and I saw this this point brought up. So last week's parasha, Parashas Yisrael, the giving of the Torah, is very exciting. It's got a lot of drama. And then kind of after it's all over, we get into the nitty-gritty. The first mitzvah we're going to talk about is Eved Ivri. And we're going to talk about damages. We're going to talk about animals. We're going to talk about a lot of things that seem very mundane, and it's like an interesting drop. You know, we start with the giving of the Torah, with all the miracles and everything that went on, and then we get into like this whole list of laws. You know, it kind of comes across a little bit like a letdown of sorts, but of course it's not a letdown because that's what the Torah is all about. The Torah is all about the mitzvahs that we were given, the mitzvahs that we're meant to live by. But I heard a very interesting analogy, I saw an interesting thought that could actually, again, bring out this simple answer, you know, that this is what the Torah is all about, in a very, very interesting way. And that is that we know that the giving of the Torah is compared to a wedding between Hashem and the Jewish people. We find in many places that Matan Torah is compared to a marriage between a man and a woman. When we received the Torah, we created a bond and a unity and a relationship with the Rabbeinu Shel Olam that is compared to that of a marriage, as close and as beautiful, as intimate as a marriage. What's interesting about marriage is the following. Let me share with you a little story. So there was a rabbi who had a group of students who were preparing to get married. And he turned to the students and he asked them, on what do you base your marriage? They were either chassanim, getting married, newly married. What do you base your marriage? So what's the answer?
Mitzvah. It's a mitzvah to get married.
Okay. Well, they answered, on love and understanding. Sounds good, right? So the rabbi said to them that although their sentiments are correct, they cannot build a marriage on love and understanding because they have, as of yet, neither loved nor understood their respective brides. Love is something that grows with understanding and the experience of sharing. You know, people supposedly fall in love. So as one rabbi said, they don't fall in love, they fall into lust. But marry, and to say that you love a person, you don't really love a person until you spend time with them, and you build a relationship, and you share with each other. And that is a process that makes the love build stronger and stronger and stronger. It's a process of building understanding of one another. But you won't really start a marriage on love. You start a marriage on commitment. Now, clearly, there's a feeling of connection between the two, that this is the person you want to grow with. But really, what's happening at that very dramatic and exciting moment is a commitment. A commitment to grow. To grow, to love each other through sharing with each other. When we talk about Matan Torah, and we compare Matan Torah to a marriage, it's the same idea. In the sense that when the Jewish people were at Matan Torah, they received the Torah, that was the wedding. That was the commitment. And that was a commitment to grow a relationship with Hashem, and eventually to reach the level of love of Hashem. But it's not like You know, you start off with the love of Hashem. You start off with a commitment. And then that commitment is to grow. That's the truth in any Jew's life. But that was on a very broad scale when the Jewish people accepted and received the Torah. That was their commitment. And then that was their commitment to form a relationship. That was a commitment to relate to each other, to share with each other, and to grow in the relationship. And therefore, when we have Parshas Mishpatim, we have the giving of the Torah, and then we go right into the laws. The way that we can look at it in a very beautiful way is that the Torah was given. It was an exciting, beautiful wedding with all the fanfare and excitement and joy. That was the point of commitment. And now's the time to now have the relationship. Now is the time to live together, to have the relationship, to share with one another, to experience life with one another, and to grow and to actually develop a very strong and intimate love. So when you talk about this kind of a possible feeling of a letdown, in the sense that, wow, Parshas Yisro was so exciting, and now we get into these very, you know, mundane laws, Eved Ivri, Hebrew slave, damages, you know, it's not just, well, that's what it's about. You know, that's the relationship. That is how the commitment that what we started off, which was so to speak, only a commitment, that which we started off with, which was only a commitment, now is the point that we will live out that commitment. And now with that commitment, create a love of the Ribbono Shel Olam. So it shouldn't be seen as a letdown, but actually it should be seen as the natural outgrowth and the natural process that has to happen, just like in a marriage, right? There's a lot of fanfare by the wedding, and then after the wedding's over and Shavuot Brachos, you know, now you gotta live life together and have a relationship with each other and build that relationship. Well, that's exactly what's happening right after Parshas Yisro. We get straight into the laws because that's the relationship. That was what we were committed to. That's the relationship. That is how we share with each other. That's how we share ourselves with the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's how we live with the Ribbono Shel Olam, and that's how we grow to love him. And with this analogy, just want to mention, we can answer another question, and that is that, you know, when we think about the giving of the Torah, so Hashem gave Moshe the first set of luchos. Those were the Ten Commandments. We know that those luchos didn't last, right? By the time Moshe Rabbeinu came down, the Jewish people had sinned by the golden calf, and he broke the luchos. He broke the tablets. And then he had to go back on Har Sinai for another 4 days and 40 nights, number one, to gain that Hashem shouldn't destroy the Jewish people for the sin of the golden calf. Came back down, went in for a third set of 40 days and 40 nights to receive the Torah again. So it's sometimes, you know, you think about it like, we have a holiday called Shavuos. We have a holiday in which we celebrate the giving of the Torah. But it's like that giving of the Torah kind of didn't work out, didn't it? You know, we started it, and then I'm sure we have to go up again, receive the Torah again, bring down the luchos again. So the first time around, you know, it was nice and exciting, but it kind of needed to be redone. So what are we celebrating on Shavuos exactly? What are you celebrating on Shavuos? The answer is, according to what we just said, we can say the answer is, Shavuos is the wedding. Because the commitment was made the first time. And the fact that that after the sin of the golden calf, the Jewish people repented, the Ribbono Shel Olam gave the Torah again. The Ribbono Shel Olam had to give the Torah again because the relationship had to be kind of changed. But the commitment was the original commitment. And it was in that original commitment that was the seed for everything that would come that would come afterwards. So even though there was a second giving of the Torah in the analogy to a wedding, the second giving of the Torah was, you know, the relationship had to be, you know, the relationship that was, when we made that first commitment, the relationship was supposed to be one way, now it had to be a little bit changed. But it's still part of the same commitment. It's still part of that commitment. That is how the commitment was made. That is how the bond was made. And that's what we're celebrating on Shavuos. Pass me a tissue, please.
Shur HaSharim, that is a metaphor, the same
right.
Metaphor
right.
Of marriage between
correct.
Am of Israel and...
correct. Israel. That is correct. Okay. All right. The next thing that I would like to talk about is we're going to skip a little bit, and we're going to go to Perek Chaf Gimel Pasuk Zayin, which is yes, it is. Perek Chaf Gimel Pasuk Zayin, which is page 434. Perek Chaf Gimel, chapter 23, Pasuk Zayin, verse 7. Midvar Sheker Tirchak. You shall distance yourself from a false word. Here the Torah is telling us. We're talking about here the importance of making sure. Let's start from Pasuk Vav. Leisata mishpat evyen chaberivai. Do not pervert the judgment of your destitute person in his grievance. Midvar sheker tirchak. Distance yourself from falsehood. V'nokav etzadik al tarig. And do not execute the innocent and the righteous. Kilayatik rasha. For I will not exonerate the wicked. So, midbar sheker tirchak, distance yourself from falsehood. This mitzvah of distancing yourself from falsehood takes on many interesting forms. On the beginning of the pasuk, where it says, right. Actually, what I think we should do, right. To look back also on page 432, Perek Chaf Gimel Pasuk Aleph. The Pasuk starts off, Loisisa Shem Hashav. Loisisa Shem Hashav means you shall not raise or you shall not accept a false report. And the explanation of what it means to not accept a false report, the Sefer HaChinuch learns that what's included in that is that a judge should not listen to the claims of one plaintiff not in front of the other one. If two people are coming to in front of a judge and each one has a case to lay out in front of the judge may not listen to one without the other being without the other one being present. The judge should not listen, a dayan rather. The judge should not listen to the claim of one, not in front of the other. That's what's included in L'sisha Shem Hashav. Do not accept a false report. And the Sefer HaChinuch explains, V'atam l'fish b'nei adam yidabru d'reishav shalib b'nei baldinam. A person won't be afraid to speak falsehood. A person will not be afraid to speak what's not true if if the person that he's having the court case with isn't there. V'tziva hadayin alzeh shaloi yachnis benavshay kazavav shal echemehen. The Torah is telling us that the judge should not allow anyone to put lies in his mind. Meaning, to go ahead and lie in front of the person who you're in the middle of a case against is much harder than when the guy's not there. It's much easier to lie about what happened when the other person who is involved in the court case isn't there. And being that is so, if the judge listens to one without the other, then he's going to hear lies. And once he starts hearing the claims of one person, which may be untrue, that is going to taint his ability to make a proper judgment. And the Mechilta also says that this prohibition of loisisa, do not accept a false report, is referring to the same case we just said, not listen to one plaintiff without the other. That this pasuk of loisisa, of not to raise a false report, is not only a law on the judge not to hear one plaintiff without the other, But it actually also includes that one plaintiff shouldn't make lay out his claims without the other one being there. It's not just about the judge not listening to it. It also includes a plaintiff not to lay out his case without the other person being there. Even if the dayan wants to hear it, he has an obligation to make sure not to do so. Also regarding this, that you should not lay out your claims in front of the judge without the other person being there, is included in what the Torah says, what we read before, distance yourself from falsehood. Because of the fact that without your opponent being there, it's easier to lie, don't do it. Don't do it. Make sure you distance yourself from a lie.
Even if it's true.
You're thinking, well, listen, you think it's true, and even if it's true, but again, you know, it may very well be that you may alter something a little bit and say something in a certain way that may not be exactly true. Or again, even if it would come out, you said 100% truth, you distance yourself from the chances of lying. Okay. So that is what's happening here, according to the Sefer Chinuch, in the mitzvah of not to accept a shem hashav, not to accept a false report, not to spread a false report, and false report, again, doesn't mean we're not talking about an outright lie. We're talking about going as far as not to listen or lay out your claim without the opponent being there. And as the Sefer Chinuch says, that the words of Pasuk Zayin, V'asheker Tirchak, distance yourself from falsehood, includes this, that you yourself should not lay out the claims without your opponent being there, even if the judge wants you to do so. Now, the Sefer Chinuch then goes into a discussion about lying, about sheker, about falsehood. Sheresh HaMitzvah Yedua, the root of this mitzvah, is well known. Ki hasheker nis'av nelach b'nei hakol. Falsehood is despised by all people. Ein davar mois mimenu. There is nothing more disgusting in it. Now, some people thrive on lying, but most people, when they see the lies, they go ahead and they realize it's a lie. Or maybe our society is just so corrupt already that, you know, lies are just the way it is. But again, lying is supposed to be something that essentially is despised by everyone. And then the Sefer Chinuch adds, v'ama'arav aklala b'beis kolayavav. Curse and destruction comes to the house of all those who love falsehood. Why? Mipnei Shehashem Yisbarach kal emes v'chalasher itoy emes. Hashem is a God of truth, and everything that is associated with Him, everything that relates to the Rebbeinu Shalom, is truth. Vein habracha metzuya v'chala ela b'mestamim eva b'maseyem. If you want to receive blessing upon you, that comes by making your actions similar to Hashem's actions. When you emulate Hashem, you make yourself similar to Hashem. Hashem is the essence of good. That is how good comes upon you. And being like Hashem means to be truthful, as God is the God of truth. And to be merciful, as we know Hashem is merciful. And to do acts of kindness like Hashem does. Meaning, being truthful, so to say, for a chinuch, falls under the category of emulating the ways of Hashem. We always talk about emulating the ways of Hashem when it comes to kindness, when it comes to mercy, which the Sefer HaChinuch mentions. But the Sefer HaChinuch also tells us that the obligation to emulate Hashem includes being truthful, because Hashem is called Emes. Hashem is Emes. Everything that relates to Hashem is the absolute Emes, the absolute truth. And where does blessing come from? It comes from emulating Hashem. If you're like Hashem, you have blessing. If you're like Hashem means, if you're kind like Hashem, you have blessing. If you're truthful, as God, Hashem is the essence of truth, you therefore are blessed. But if, let's say, someone's actions are the opposite of what Hashem is, that a person's actions are false, which is the opposite of the traits of Hashem. If you act in the opposite way of Hashem's traits, then what will rest upon you is also the opposite of Hashem's traits. The trait of Hashem, the essence of Hashem, is good, is blessing. So if you're like Hashem, you now receive blessing. If you decide to be the opposite of the Ribbono Shel Olam, to be the opposite of Hashem, then you'll have, so to speak, what is not meant to be the traits of Hashem. You will not have the trait of Hashem, which is goodness. You'll have the opposite of that. If you're going to act like the opposite of Hashem, you'll have the opposite of what Hashem, of Chas V'Shalom, not to say that bad doesn't come from Hashem, but what Hashem's essence is, which is the ultimate good. So if a person wants to be able to experience the ultimate and obvious and good that can really be appreciated, which is the essence of Hashem, then you have to be like Hashem. If you do the opposite, then you're going to experience what so to speak, he calls the opposite of Hashem's trait, or the opposite of the trait that Hashem wants to go ahead and shower upon people. Okay? So that is, so he says, v'hepach midas habracha, what's the opposite of the trait of blessing? Shehi boy, which is in Hashem, v'hamar v'akola, that's curse. And the opposite of joy and peace and enjoyment that's with Hashem, who are daigavak tatavatzar. That's worry, that's strife, and that's suffering. Okay? Therefore, the Torah warned us to distance ourselves from falsehood, as the Torah says. Torah says, doesn't it just say, don't do a Dvar Sheker, don't speak a Dvar Sheker, distance yourself from falsehood. There's no other warning the Torah gives us. The Torah says, distance yourself from that. The Torah says, don't eat non-kosher food. It doesn't say, distance yourself from non-kosher food. But when it comes to Sheker, when it comes to falsehood, the Torah says, tirchak, distance yourself. Why? Because that's how despised falsehood is. And the same way the Ribbono Shel Olam, the way the Ribbono Shel Olam's traits, the way he acts, the way we perceive him, it's meant to, the way the Ribbono Shel Olam wants us to perceive him is to perceive him as the one that showers good upon us. Well, the way that we will be able to experience those traits of Hashem is if we make ourselves like Hashem, if we emulate Hashem, if we're truthful, and therefore we follow the traits of Hashem, we'll now experience the traits of Hashem, the traits of how Hashem wants us to wants to interact with us and wants us to perceive Him. But if we're going to be the opposite of what the Ribbono Shel Olam of the opposite of what the Ribbono Shel Olam's traits are, then we're going to get the opposite of the traits. The opposite of the traits that Hashem wants to bestow upon us, which is blessing, and instead we'll get the traits He doesn't want, which are the traits of punishment and distress and suffering. Okay, so that is the Sefer HaChinuch's discussion about Sheker, about falsehood. So now I want to share with you an interesting discussion that I saw, and it's a discussion about Sheker, about being about not being truthful, and what I saw here is an analysis of a following scenario, and this is the following scenario that we could definitely relate to. So let's imagine we have Reuben and Shimon. Reuben owes Shimon money. And they made up that Shimon is going to pay Reuben by a certain date. Reuben has not done so. So Shimon calls up Reuben, and he wants to speak to him and tell him, you know, the time for payment has come. But Reuben doesn't want to speak to Shimon. So when Shimon calls up in the house, and his wife picks up the phone, and he says, "Hi, this is Shimon. Is your husband home?" So what does Reuben say to his wife? "Tell him I'm not home." Now, that's a lie. But what if Shimon decides that, so that his wife shouldn't have to say a lie, which she may not want to, he'll step outside of the house. And he's not home anymore because he's outside of the house. And now he can go in and tell his wife, "Tell him I'm not home." And like this, she's not lying. He's talking at home. Now, Shimon, the point of Shimon's point of whether he's home or not is not about is he home, it's about is he available to speak. But he's trying to push off Shimon. He's trying, and he wants to make it that his wife doesn't have to say a lie. So he stands outside the house, so she can say he's not home. She's not saying a lie. They're clearly misleading Shimon, but she didn't say a lie. So is that true? Is that okay? Is that called, did she say a lie? Did she not say a lie? You know, it doesn't sound right. Okay, it doesn't sound right. But again, you know, if at the end of the day we can argue, we can make an argument and say that she didn't lie, so she didn't, okay, she didn't lie. She didn't lie. She misled, yeah, but she didn't lie. You know? Can we find some sources that would help us understand, you know, is this something that we can say is, you know, no one's going to say that it's the great, that it's a very, that it's a proper character trait to be misleading. But again, you know, the Torah say, does it fall within what Torah says, distance yourself from lying, doesn't it? Do we have, there's some interesting proofs here. Now the Gemara in the Nedarim gives the following scenario. The Gemara in the Nedarim is talking about a certain kind of case where a person is going to make an oath. And the discussion is that when he makes an oath, is it possible that when he makes the oath, he is saying certain words. And when he says those words, his intention is according to how he wants those words to be understood. Is he swearing according to the way people understand, or is he swearing according to whatever he has in mind, whatever he means? And the Gemara brings down a halacha that when we make a person swear in a basin, in a rabbinical court, so they say to the person, have a yedeya, be aware, when we make you swear, we're not making you swear according to the conditions in your heart. Meaning, we're not telling you to swear according to what your intent is for what the word should mean. But rather, you're doing it based on our intent and the intent of the Beis Din. Meaning, you can't get up and say after you swore, well, I meant this. When you swear, you need to be swearing according to the way the Beis Din, according to the way we want it to be understood. It can't be according to the way you want it to mean, it has to be according to the way we want it to mean. Okay, well, that sounds like, okay, so the Beis, so there, clearly we see a halacha here that Beis Din has to tell you, right, that when you swear, we want you swearing according to our understanding, which would imply that without that, a person would swear, could possibly be swearing based on what he means to say, what he wants it to mean. And the Gemara says that this case where we're making him swear and telling him, this is not based on how you translate the words, of what your intent for the words are, but rather it has to be based on what we want the words to mean, is referring to the following case. Now this guy was a clever guy. He was very clever. The story goes that, again, we had two people, we'll just call them Reuven and Shimon for convenience sake, and they came, the Gemara talks about, they came in front of the sage Rava. And Reuven said to Shimon, Shimon had borrowed money from Reuven. Reuven says to Shimon, you got to pay me. And Shimon says, I paid you. Now, the judge who was Rava basically invoked a very basic halacha. If I say to you, you owe me money, and you say, I paid you, the halacha is, and this is an enactment of the Rabbanan, you have to swear. You have to swear that you paid. If you're saying, meaning, if you're agreeing that you are obligated, but you paid, it's really coming upon you to make an oath. This is not a Torah oath, this is rabbinic. They obligated the person who's saying, I don't owe money, to have to pay. Okay? To have to swear. He has to swear. If he said he paid, he has to swear. So the guy said, fine, I'm going to swear. But before he swore, I guess there was a time period in between taking the actual oath, he went home and he took his cane, and in the hollow of the cane, he stuck in the money that he owed. And when he came to Beis Din leaning on the cane. Now, when you make an oath in the Beis Din, you have to hold a Sefer Torah. You need both hands. So he said to the lender, could you hold my cane? Get what he's trying to do? And he went ahead and he took the Sefer Torah and he swore that whatever money I had of yours, I paid you back. And he swore. Now, he was swearing I paid you because he gave me out of money. the guy was holding the money. But the other guy didn't, and his whole intention was to be able to swear, get out of a false oath, and then get the money back. But he could say, you know, basically he said to him, let me just make sure I got the words here right. Yeah. He says, and he swore that he paid whatever he had. Now, the lender was furious because the lender knew he was swearing falsely. He got so angry, he took the stick and he whacked it on the ground. And it popped open and came out the money. So the Gemara says that when a Beis Din tells a person that you have to realize that you're not swearing according to your understanding, it's according to our understanding. It was actually to cover this kind of case. Because in this case, right, it would see basically, as the Gemara says, Mishtachach to Kushti Shtaba. Right? It would come out that he swore properly. Right? That's what would come out. It would come out he swore properly. It comes out that if not for Beis Din telling him, you got to swear according to what we mean, that basically he would have sworn the truth. He would have said, I paid you, and it would have been considered a payment, even though the guy didn't know about it. Or at least it would have been considered that he paid, that he didn't swear falsely. Therefore, the Beis Din tells him that realize that when you swear, right? No matter what you think you're saying, no matter what your intent is to what you mean to say, it doesn't count the way you think, it means what we think. And when you tell us that you paid, that means you really paid. And therefore, if you swear, you know, I paid, right? But you're playing this kind of shtick, right? Then at the end of the day, you have sworn falsely. So basically, what you see from the Gemara here is that if this person were to actually, you know, if after Beis Din went ahead and told him that you got to be swearing according to the way we understand, if he actually swore thinking what he understood, right, that would be considered a false oath. That would be considered false. Now, So here we have an example of where if you try to be misleading, it's considered false, right? That's what we seemingly have here. If you are trying to be misleading, right, you're trying, I didn't say a lie, you know, hey, look, you know, I swore I paid, I didn't say a lie. Well, basically, in order for you, now again, if we wouldn't have told you that, right, if we wouldn't have told you, right, that you have to be swearing according to what we mean, then it wouldn't have been swearing falsely, and we'd have gotten away with it. So in order to prevent them from getting away with it, right, we tell them, the meaning of what you're saying is not what you think, the meaning of what you're saying is what we think. And therefore, if you're fooling us, you're going and swearing falsely. So here is an example where if you're going to be misleading, it's considered false. Now, you may say, well, okay, but maybe that's by swearing. Maybe by swearing, right? By swearing, you know, and especially in this case where we say to the guy, you know, look, you got to mean what we say, what we want it to mean. Okay, so that's where being misleading is a lie. That's where you're saying is being a lie, because basically we said to you, what you're saying has to be according to what we think. Okay, so maybe because of the fact that they went ahead and they actually told him that, and they made that up with him, okay, that's when it's a lie. But maybe otherwise without that, even if I did mislead you, it doesn't fall under the context of a lie. So here's another Gemara. Gemara in Shavuos. Where the Gemara...
I just want to say that intent, the motivation of the guy is very important. So if he's trying to hide something, if his intent to... mislead the person.
He's clearly trying to mislead the person.
So this is a lie.
It may not be a lie. It may not be a sheker, because maybe sheker is only when I say a sheker. Maybe the definition of sheker is when I say a sheker. If I say a sheker, if I don't say falsehood, then it's not, clearly it's not an appropriate thing. The question is, how bad is it? You know, how bad is it? Is it actually sheker? Which is when if we call that sheker, then we can call it a much more damaging thing, more damaging to yourself, right? Could be that if it's not a sheker, right, it's not as severe, right? It's not right. It's not nice. It's not nice. It's not menschlich. You would never want somebody to do that to you. The question is, though, does it fall under sheker? Because if it's sheker, it's much more serious. So here's the Gemara in Shavuos. And the Gemara in Shavuos is talking about examples of Midvash Sheker Tirchak. Gemara is talking about when the Torah says Midvash Sheker Tirchak, distance yourself from Sheker, the Gemara goes through a number of examples of what's included in that. So the Gemara starts off like this. Minayin l'talmud shamar lo rabbi. What does a student do? How do you know? Regarding the following case, a student is told by his Rebbe, by his teacher, Yedea tabish im naisili mea mana, any mavada mana, any mavada. You know that a person gives me, if somebody would give me loads of money, I would never make up a story. You know I'm not that kind of guy. I don't make up stories for money. Money ishli etzel plaini. I have a lot of money by someone. I lent a lot of money to a person. And he's not paying me back. And I only have one witness. One witness can't make him pay. How do you know that the student shouldn't join up to be the second witness? The Gemara says, that's what the Pasuk says when it said, that's what the Pasuk means, distance yourself from a lie. The Gemara asks, wait a minute, what do you want this student to do as the second witness? You want him to testify falsely? The Rebbe says, you know I'm making up a story, you know it's the truth. So come and be a second witness. What, lie? Because you know I'm telling the truth, so come and lie? You can't do that. So the Gemara says, here's the case. The Rebbe says to the student, Chas v'shalom, I don't want you to lie. Just come and pretend like you're a second witness. Just show up. I have one witness, show up with him. The borrower is going to look and say, oh my gosh, he's got two witnesses. And he'll admit. But you don't have to say anything wrong. You don't have to say a lie. Don't say a lie. Just come, pretend like you're a witness so that I can get what's rightfully mine. Says the Gemara. That's what the Torah says when it means, that's included when the Torah says, Mevashek HaTerechak, distance yourself from falsehood. So even though the student is not going to testify falsely, and he's not even going to say false, but he is going to give an appearance of falsehood, that goes into Midrash Sheker Tirchak, distance yourself from falsehood. That falls into, Gemara says, that falls into what the Torah means when it says, stay away from falsehood. Distance yourself from falsehood. You have to go ahead and not have any connection to falsehood. And therefore, if the Gemara says that a misleading action is Midrash Sheker Tirchak, so either it's the same or worse to say words that are misleading. And therefore, in the case where a person goes out and tells his wife, tell him I'm not home and you're standing outside, right? So you're telling her to be misleading, that could very well fall into Midrash Sheker Tirchak. Distance yourself from that, from falsehood. Now, a question that's asked is that if you recall, going back to Parshas Toldos, when Rivka told Yaakov to dress up as Esav, so Yaakov shows up, Yitzchak says to Yaakov, you know, who are you? What does he answer? Ani Esav b'char, ani. Let me just make sure I'm saying it right. Right. Mi'at tabini. Who are you, my son? V'yom Yaakov alavim. Yaakov said to his father, Anoichi Esav b'charecha. I, Esav, your firstborn. So Rashi says that when Yaakov said these words, Anoichi Esav b'charecha, I, Esav, your firstborn, Yaakov said those words, but he meant Anoichi, I, Esav b'cherecha, Esav is your firstborn. That's what Yaakov meant. But that's clearly not what Yaakov said. That's not how Yitzchak understood it, and that's not how Yaakov wanted Yitzchak to understand it. He wanted Yitzchak to understand it as, Ani Esav b'cherecha, I am Esav, your firstborn. Right? Yaakov seemingly is trying to get out of the lie by saying these words, but, you know, I mean something else, so I'm not lying. But we see that doesn't work, right? We see that doesn't work. So how did he do it? And the answer that's given is that Yaakov's situation was a situation where he was allowed to be misleading, right? That's a discussion in the commentaries. How could Yaakov do this? How could Yaakov be deceitful? And one answer is Esav was deceitful. And therefore Yaakov needed to be deceitful to get to do what he had to do. There's discussions of how, why was it permissible for Yaakov to do this? Now, once it's established that it's permissible to do, Yaakov Avinu says, even though it's permissible for me to basically be involved in shekher and falsehood, I'm going to minimize it. I'm going to decrease it. I'm going to do less of a shekher. I'm permitted to basically be involved in falsehood, but I'm going to make the falsehood less false if I can. And therefore, although I'm involved in falsehood, when I say Ani Esav b'cherecha, and Yaakov is trying to convey to Yitzchak, I am Esav, your firstborn, once he's allowed to do it, there's a reason he's allowed to. Fine, he's allowed to. Once he's allowed to, Yaakov says, I'm going to do something to minimize the lie. Meaning, even when it's permissible to say what's not true, do your best to minimize the falsehood. But to go ahead and mislead a person when you shouldn't mislead a person, but you want to justify it by saying, well, I didn't say a lie, that you can't do. Because if you mislead a person through your words, that's sheker, that's falsehood. That's what the Torah said, distance yourself from falsehood. Stay away from any kind of falsehood. But if it's permissible to go ahead and now be involved and say something that's not true, Yaakov taught us, try to keep it as true as you can. Yes, the message you're conveying is one thing, what your intent is something else, but yes, say words that could mean something true. That's the better way to lie. And the Aruch HaTzaddikim, famous Musa Sefer, actually says that the Gemara talks about a number of cases where a person is allowed to say what's not true, right? The famous one is to make peace between husband and wife, make peace between people, you can say something that's not true, right? A person's getting married, right, to a bride. What are you allowed to say to the chassan? Kalanava chasuda, right? She's beautiful. And maybe she's not. But the point is, and you're saying it, and you know, it's not true. For you, it's not true. Okay, you're trying to convey to the chassan that you also think that he got a great catch, and you don't really agree to that, but you're allowed to say what's not true, at least again what you feel is not true for that person's benefit. Another example is if somebody asks you, you know, hey, do you know a mesech? Do you know a tractate from the Gemara? Do you know this tractate well? The Gemara says you're allowed to say no. It's out of modest humility. You could say, no, I don't know it. Even though it's not true. You're allowed to say it's not true. Says that, Aruch HaTzaddikim, that, you know, if somebody asks you, do you know this Masechta? Even though you're allowed to say no, which is not true, but you're allowed to say that falsehood, you know what you should say if you can? You should say, do you think I know that? So basically, again, you're trying to convey that you don't know it. Is that true? No, it's not true. You do know it. But you're not saying the falsehood directly. It's better to say something that the words are not false and just misleading than to say words that are actually false. So it's, again, only once it's permissible to be misleading, only once it's permissible to, so to speak, be involved in what's not true, and to convey what's not true, if you can minimize the falsehood in your words, that's the better way to go. And that's what Yaakov Avinu was doing. So at the end of the day, so again, you know, to go ahead and say, tell him I'm not home. That's, you know, and you're standing there in the house, that's an outright lie. Going ahead and standing outside, we'll call it not an outright lie, but you're being misleading, but you're telling the other person to be misleading, would seem to fall under Midrash HaGaterecha, distance yourself from something that's not true. And therefore would be the wrong thing to do. Okay. Let's now... get a lot of time. Okay. Let's go... Perek Chaf Beis Pasuk Chaf Dalet. This is page 430. Im Kesev Talva Es Ami Es Ha'ani Imach. When you lend money to the poor person who is with you, loisia loikanoisha, do not act towards him like a creditor. The simitul of neshach, do not put lay interest upon him. Torah is telling us when you lend somebody money, you're not allowed to take interest. Now, the wording is very interesting because it says, im kesef talves ami. Literally translated means, if you will lend money to my people. What do you mean, if? You have an obligation. If you can lend money to a person, he asks you for money, you got to give it to him. It's a mitzvah. So why does it say if? Says Rashi, there are a couple of times where the Torah uses the word im, which typically means if, and it means when. So here it says im kesef talves ami, which we would have translated as if you will lend money to my people. You have to translate it as when you will lend money to my people. There is another example of this at the end of last week's parsha. And that is on page 414, Perek Chaf, Pasuk Chaf Beis. The imizbach avarim tasali, if you will make a altar of stone for me, loisivnes and gazes, you shall not build them from hewn stone. Now here Rashi points out, the Pasuk says, v'imizbeach avonim. Imizbeach avonim. If you will build for me a altar of stone. Rashi says, it shouldn't be if, it should be when. Because, as Rashi says, Rabbi Shmuel Oimer, kol im v'im shabat Torah v'shus. Anywhere it says the Torah, the word im, if, it means something that is voluntary. It's up to you to do. Chutz mi gimel. Three exceptions. V'mizbeach avadim tasali. If you will make a stone altar for me. Here, it can't be if, it's when. Okay? It's when you build for me a stone altar, because eventually there was an obligation to build an altar from stone. Okay? That is what's going to be. It's not if you will build an altar of stone. It's really when. Because that's exactly what's going to happen. You have an obligation to make an altar of stone. As it says, it'll be complete stones. Okay? That's one example. The next example is what we just read. V'chaydim kesav talva. If you will lend. Chayvahi. It's an obligation to lend. It's not if. So again, it means when. And the third example is v'chein v'im takra minchas bikurim. The pasuk says in Vayikra, if you will offer a meal offering of your first fruits. The meal offering of your first fruits is what we call the omer offering. That's from the barley that ripens first. It's called minchas bikurim because it's from the first grain that ripens. And the Torah says v'im minchas bikurim. If you will bring the Omer, it's not an if, it's a when, it's an obligation. You have to bring the carbon Omer. So therefore, it says, Rashi brings down that from that everywhere im means if, which means you could do it, it's up to you to do it. Three times where it says if, it really means you have to do it. And it means when you'll do it. So the Gur Aryeh, the Maral, basically asks, okay, fine, you got a point. It has to be that even though it says im, it can't mean if because it's a when. So why did the Torah say if? So the Maharal explains by all three cases why the Torah said if. And he says like this, Yesh lefarash mashakasav lashon im ap agav dechay behem. We can explain why did the Torah say if. Why did the Torah use the word im, which typically means if it's really an obligation. Because if you do these things only out of obligation, only out of a sense of obligation, you don't want to do it. You're only doing it because you have to do it. This will not be pleasing to Hashem. You need to do this out of your own goodwill. And when you do it out of your goodwill, then it's going to be accepted. An act that is a forced act. Okay, all he's doing is fulfilling the king's decree. And when it comes to these three things, where we have the word in, what it means when. If you do these three things only out of the obligation to fulfill the decree of the king, ain't zedavar. Almost sounds like it's not worth anything. Very strong language. That when it comes to these three things, if you don't do these three things out of your own will, then what you're doing is really, really lacking. Ki imbayne mizbeach. If you build an altar, shezeu avaydasa yisparak lach rivalav. What's an altar for? To bring sacrifices. To do the ultimate divine worship. And why are you bringing the carbon? I have to. I don't want to, but I have to. Ein zavayda. That's not worship. That's not service. You want to be an oved? You want to be one who serves God? You want to be a servant of Hashem? Then it's got to come from your heart. It's got to be that you want to serve. If you're forced, ein ze oved. The word oved is so funny. We use the word oved for labor, but really the way he's using the word oved means to serve. You want to be a server. You want to be a person who's a worshiper, but a true worshiper. You want to be an oved. It's got to come from the heart. It's got to come from your good will, from your will. If not, you're not doing the service. It's like you're not doing the service then. Let's say you lend the money because I gotta give tzedakah. I don't want to give tzedakah, but what can I do? I'm obligated. Ain't a mitzvah. Hard word. That's harsh words. It's not a mitzvah. Kitzar shi a mitzvah salva meritzayne b'leiv atayv. When it comes to lending money, when it comes to giving tzedakah, it's got to be from. It has to be with a good heart. It has to be with a willing heart. With a giving heart. As it says, even by giving, it shouldn't be bad in your heart. So another example. If when it comes to lending money, when it comes to doing the mitzvah of lending money, if you do it because you have to, ain't a mitzvah. That's very heavy words. It's not a mitzvah. Does he actually mean it's not a mitzvah at all? I can't say. But he clearly is saying that your mitzvah is sorely missing. Because helping someone, lending somebody money, has to be done from the goodness of your heart. So too when it comes to offering the Omer offering. We know the Torah tells us you may not eat from the new grain until you offer the Omer. Upirshu Razal, our sages explain what is this mitzvah about. Ki yisparach maila anonim, the Rebbein Shalaylam brings clouds, umayvid kshamim, he brings down rain, mafriach tlalim, he brings down the dew, matzmiach adam medashana peiris, he causes the ground to sprout forth, and he brings out beautiful, delicious fruits. Va'ana noiseloi scharoi oimer hakarben. And what do we give back to him? How do we pay him back? How do we show our recognition? We bring the Omer carbon. That's how we're showing our recognition, our gratitude. All this is to demonstrate that we know that he was the one who caused the fruits to grow and has given it to us. You want to express your thanks? It's got to come from your heart. We're not talking about here if like a flesh and blood king that says, recognize me as king or else. But rather you need to admit, you need to thank, you need to acknowledge with from your heart that he has given us everything from his hand. But if you do the mitzvah of bringing the Omer because you have to do it, that's not thanking Hashem, that's not acknowledging that Hashem has created everything. Therefore, all these things are an obligation. The Torah says, if, because the Torah is telling us, you know how you have to do it? You have to do this if you had a choice to do it. Don't do it as someone who doesn't have a choice to do it. Do it like someone who does have a choice to do it. And it's especially by these three things. Divine worship, which we would include davening nowadays. Lending a person money, tzedakah. And whatever we do to show our gratitude to Hashem. If we're doing it because we have to, then it's missing. It's completely void. It's completely missing. Again, I'm not going to go in and say there's no mitzvah whatsoever, but the mitzvah is missing so much of what it's supposed to be. These are three things that if they're going to have any kind of real meaning, it has to come from the heart. And that's why the Torah said, if.
I always thought that motivation and the intent are very important. Just want to say that, you know, before that, when we talk about distancing yourself from the, you know, wrong saying, I think the motivation and the intent plays a big role.
Definitely. But it makes it plays a big role in actually making it be considered checker. Because even though what you said may have been sheker, but since the intent is to create a falsehood from it, that's called saying falsehood. And saying falsehood is considered a very serious wrongful act.
Yeah, it's a good distinction, right?
Okay. Have a good night.
Thank you, Robert.